This morning, as you can see, we are continuing our study in God's revelation of the future, which is what I've titled this series. If you look at the first four bullets there, we have already covered these sections, if you will. We've dealt with the rapture, the 70 weeks of Daniel, and the Olivet Discourse, which are two incredibly important passages relative to the future. We did a brief overview of the book of Revelation, and then we covered the sealed trumpet and bowl judgments. Now, as I have been doing the book of Revelation itself, I've not done it chapter by chapter, as you well know. We've done it, first of all, we've done what I think is the chronological order, which is sees the seals unfolded, and then the trumpet sounded, and the bowls poured out. And so that's the way we're approaching it. So at this point, we're going to begin looking at the sections, basically, of Revelation that we have skipped. Now, unfortunately, time does not permit us to review what we've done. We just have 10 weeks. Three weeks in the quarter will be dedicated to other things, so we'll have 10 weeks. However, I will make this note, and I think I did have reference to this website in your handout. If you're interested, if you missed anything last quarter or you want to go back and look at anything, this is the website that you'll find the information. And if you go there, this is what you'll see, and you'll notice that there is a teaching series section that will lead you to here, and you'll see God's revelation of the future. And there are the 10 lessons that we covered last quarter, and Lord willing, as we go week by week, I will add the current ones to that as well. So that gives you an idea, a place to go if you need to review something or if you would like to review something. So where are we going? Where are we? We are now going to look at what some authors have termed the insets of Revelation. We're basically looking at the section of Revelation that covers chapter 6 through 1 through chapter 19, verse 10. And the insets are the parts of the book or the visions that John received that basically interrupt the flow of the seal, trumpet, and bowl judgments. So that's what we're going to see, and here is a list of the insets as we'll find them. And notice you see the seal judgments, and then there's a couple of other visions, the seventh seal and the six trumpets, and then there's a couple of visions. The seventh trumpet, which is, I think as we found, a very significant point in the happenings of what God is doing. And then there's a whole series of visions that John receives. Finally, the bowls are dumped out. And then we have in Revelation 17 and 18, the judgment of Babylon. And then in the early verses of chapter 19, the rejoicing that's going on there in heaven. And so we're going to start this morning by looking at the 144,000 sealed, the great multitude. And because of the relationship between the 144,000 sealed and this later vision that John sees in chapter 14, we'll look at that this morning as well. So let's look here at what John tells us. By the way, if anybody didn't get a handout on the way in, there are some handouts. Anyone else need one? I'll be good. Okay. So basically what we're looking at here is a vision which describes events surrounding the sealing of 144,000 Jews living here on earth. Probably, I think this is early in the 70th week. And again, I'll refer to this period primarily as the 70th week rather than the tribulation period, which is we often refer to it, because the 70th week is the terminology that Daniel uses to mark out. Remember, the 70th week is started with a signing of a covenant. It's not started with the rapture of the church. It's started with the signing of a covenant. And then that period runs for exactly, precisely 7 years, and remember, these are 7 prophetic years, not 7 calendar years. So it runs its course, and so, you know, the book of Revelation is largely dealing with this period of the 70th week in these chapters. So let's look here at what John writes here in 7:1. So he's just described in chapter 6 the unsealing of the first 6 seals, and now he continues with what he sees next. He says, "After this I saw." Now, as we go through these different insects, you're going to see a number of times John uses this phrase, "after this," this phrase, and it's indicating that I saw this, and after this I saw this, and after this I saw this. And as suggested, as we see recorded these visions in the book of Revelation, I think they're recorded in the order that John sees them. They are not necessarily describing events that are in chronological order. We're going to find that some of them talk about events that are later, some earlier, and then there's some overlap, of course, in these events. So what John is telling, what John has written here in the book of Revelation, he's recorded in the order that he saw these events. So he says, "I saw 4 angels standing on the 4 corners of the earth." Now, so these angels are here on earth, not in heaven, and the location is given as the 4 corners of the earth. So what does this phrase mean? I mean, we probably, you know, especially us today who have seen pictures of the earth from space, we know that there are not 4 corners on a globe. So obviously the language here is figurative, and I, you know, Google is such a resource, good or bad sometimes, but I Googled this, what does 4 corners of the earth mean? And here's what Google responded. 4 corners of the earth is an idiom that means all parts of the world or everywhere, essentially referring to the furthest reaches of the globe, even though the earth isn't literally square with corners. It's used to signify people or things coming from diverse locations across the planet. So here it's, you can see that there's probably this global idea, but even so, there evidently is, and somehow, these 4 angels are standing at 4 points, if you will, on Earth, because it says they're standing there, and we don't know where they're standing. Later, we're going to see reference to the 4 winds and things like that. So it's important to understand that here we see angels coming, standing on earth, and they're going to be given a particular mission as we see unfolded here. Now, let me just say one thing about this idea of earth. This is standing, holding back the 4 winds of the earth, the 4 corners of the earth. As we find it there, some people, generally when I see this word earth, I understand it in two senses. One, globally, in the sense of this is planet Earth. And the other, as I noted here, that it might not blow on, I think the ESV has earth or on the sea. Now, when it's contrasted with sea, I often think it's better to understand it as land. So as a contrast, it's not blowing on the land and it's not blowing on the sea. But some people see this idea that the earth is really referring to, or land is really referring to just the Middle East, and sea is really just referring to the Mediterranean Sea. So they would understand to some extent that the judgments of the book of Revelation are somehow limited to that area of the Middle East. I tend not to think that, because I think there are other places in the book of Revelation where it becomes, it to me, clear that God has a global scope in mind here. Now, it is true, when John and those men were living here on earth, they had no concept of the earth as we have it. There's no way they understood it as a globe at least it doesn't seem that they understood it as a globe revolving around the sun and things like that. However, I think that is the perspective here. And interestingly, who wrote this book? John. And John had been caught up to heaven, and now John is seeing things here on earth. So maybe John did have a perspective that we understand of the earth as John looked at what was going on here on planet earth. So these angels are holding back the four winds. Probably the four winds idea is the four compass points. We don't know when this started, but John says they're presently doing, and we don't know when it will cease. But it says that no wind might blow, no wind blowing anywhere on the earth. If you've ever looked at, for example, your weather app on your phone will often show you all the directions the wind is blowing. It's interesting to see the patterns that the wind. But it's hard to envision a time when there is no wind blowing anywhere. That's not the way it works. It's always blowing. So these angels have somehow stopped that. It says on the land or sea or any tree. So it includes all the land surface, all the surface of the sea, and any tree. I think any tree, you know, why does John add any tree there? I think he does in a sense because often we notice the wind by what? The leaves blowing on the trees. And I think that's kind of why John may have added that there. He says, then he saw these four angels. Then I saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun. So John, again, you can see his perspective is from the earth, and he's looking, if you will, east, the direction of the rising of the sun. So he sees an angel, and the angel has the seal of the living God. Now, the word seal here is the same word that's used for the seven seals that sealed the scroll. Now, it's interesting here. In that case, the word seal is referring to, if you will, the wax imprint that sealed the scroll. In other words, there are seven seals, and as Jesus breaks those seals, it unveils judgments that will take place. Here, the word seal is used of the thing that produces the seal, like a signet ring. So the word is used in both ways. So, and notice the angel is carrying the seal of the living God. Now, when you stop and think about that, think of the authority that this angel possesses in carrying God's seal. God has given him this seal, and he's going to use it with other angels. And so this seal is a seal that represents no higher authority. It is God's seal, as we're told here. And so what does this seal represent? I think in this case, we can say that there may be two related ideas. One is a sense of ownership, and the other is a sense of protection or security. And apparently here, especially that idea of protection, is in play. If you look in chapter 9, verses 3 and 4, this is up with the fifth trumpet, John writes, then the smoke came locusts on the earth, and they were given power like the power of scorpions of the earth. They were told not to harm the grass of the land or any green plant or any tree, but only those people who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. So you can see, at least as this passage represents, in some sense, this is a seal that's protecting these individuals from this locust attack that's taking place there under the fifth trumpet. However, note that apparently, although protected, this group will be in heaven before the end of the 70th week. Now, we'll talk about how they get there when we look at the other vision, but they will be there apparently before the end of the 70th week. So this fifth angel called aloud to the four angels. He's the one holding the seal, and these four angels who have given power to harm land and sea. So John observes that these angels who are presently holding the winds in check have the power to harm, indicating that there is some judgment that they will unleash later. And we are told exactly what the fifth angel says to them. He says, "Do not harm the land or the sea or the trees." And this is just a repetition of what we saw earlier. So we are not told in what sense they're able to harm these, but I would say in some sense it involves the wind, since that's what they're holding back at this point. And obviously from recent events, we're well aware of what the wind can do as it brings down trees and the like. So he says, do not this until, so a time is coming when they will no longer be restrained. So he says, till we have sealed the servants of our God on their forehead. So these angels, using the seal that the fifth angel has, will seal the servants of our God. So these are God's servants whom they're sealing, and they will do it with that seal that's the fifth angel possesses. Now, recall when we talked about the rapture of the church, we said after the rapture of the church, there will be no believers on the earth for that. Instantly, every believer on earth will be caught up to be with Christ in the air, and that will leave no believers on earth. However, it is clear from the book of Revelation and other passages that there will be those that are saved during this 70th week period. And that's exactly what we're seeing here. This God has in some way brought these 144,000, who we're going to define here shortly, to salvation. They are called his servants, and they are going to be sealed. Now, it's interesting. In the balance of the book of Revelation, there is no other reference to any believers being sealed in the same way that these 144,000 are going to be sealed. So I think that what we can derive from that is that somehow they have a special mission. A mission is being given to them. They're being marked out for this mission, and that's what God is going to use them for. And it's interesting, who is speaking here? An angel is speaking, and notice he uses our God. You know, angel, you know, is later we're going to see, or we've talked about the fact that an angel talks to John when John gets ready to fall down and worship, and says, no, we're just fellow servants, just like you, and God is our God, just as he is your God. And they're going to be sealed on their foreheads. In 14:1, which we're going to look at in a bit, we read this: "Then I looked, and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb, and with him 144,000 who had his name and his Father's name written on their foreheads." So here we're told that these 144,000 are sealed, or have the seal is placed on their foreheads, and then later it's said that this seal at least includes the name of the Father and the name of the Son. So in these verses, we have identified the servants of God who will be sealed, and it says John heard the number being sealed. So John is not guessing here. John knows precisely how many are going to be sealed. In other places, we see John estimating the great multitude, myriads and myriads. Here, the number is precise. So John is clear. And he says, from every tribe of the sons of Israel. Now, when we read that statement, I want to make two, I think we can draw two important conclusions. First of all, I think this indicates that God has a future for Israel and that the church has not replaced them. They're going to be here, and here's talking about 144,000 of them that will be sealed. And the second thing I think that is important to note here is that this is from every tribe. And we know there are 12 tribes, 12 sons of Jacob, 12 sons of Israel. However, if you look at this list carefully and you're aware of the names of the 12 sons of Jacob, you'll notice that one of the sons is missing. And his name is not actually in the list. We'll see that Dan, who is the fifth son of Jacob, is not included in the list. However, Joseph is included, as is Joseph's son, Manasseh. So, what's going on here? Here's a list, or actually three lists, of the sons of Jacob. The first list is the order in which they were born. By the way, the color there indicates their mother. There are four different mothers involved in these 12 children. So the first list is the order in which they are born. The second list is the order in which Jacob blesses them in Genesis 49. And even so, the order is not the same. But notice Dan is included in both of those lists. But when you get to this list here in Revelation 7, notice Dan is missing, but now we have Manasseh. And so the question is, why is Dan not listed? Well, some have suggested, and I don't really have a good answer, but some have suggested that it relates to some historical issues related to the tribe of Dan. And you can look back in Judges 18, if you will, and you'll see that there are some issues. However, let me say this. Clearly, Dan will be there. Clearly, he will. There are future references to Dan in the millennium. We find them in the Old Testament. If you look, for example, in Ezekiel 48, Dan is included among the tribal land division. So we know that Dan will be there. And in his name is one on one of the city gates in the millennium. So 144,000 are sealed. One of them will be, or 12 of them will be from the tribe of Dan, even though it seems that Manasseh, for some reason, has been substituted for him in this list. So 144,000 are sealed. So this begs the question, what is the role of this 144,000 who are sealed? Now, as I suggested earlier, I think there is a unique place or unique ministry that is being given to this people. That's why God has sealed them. Some believe that this group will form a worldwide missions force. And that's consistent with the fact that the Jews were to be witnesses to the nation. And if you recall, when we looked at the Olivet Discourse, Jesus said the gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations. So during this period of time, Jesus says, listen, the gospel will be proclaimed throughout the whole world. And furthermore, I think this may be the right idea because the very next vision that we see here recorded by John involves a great multitude of believers who come out of this tribulation period. So I think that that may lend some credence to the idea that this is a worldwide missionary force. And this may be God's mechanism. Again, the church is gone. The testimony of the church is gone, and God is going to replace it, if you will, with this 144,000 who will go out throughout the earth. At least that's what it seems to be. This brings us to the next area, the great multitude, the next vision. In this vision, John sees a great multitude of believers who have been killed on earth and who are now appear before God's throne in heaven, worshiping. And so John says, after this, I looked. He had just seen the vision of the 144,000. Now this one. Some have noted that this is one of the bright spots in the book of Revelation, especially in these chapters of 6:1 to 19:10. And even though these are martyrs, they are that, martyrs. John is going to describe a great number, a multitude of people who are saved, who have come to faith during this period of time. And so he said it's a great number that no one could number, a multitude that no one could number. So basically he says, if you tried to estimate it, it would even be wrong. It can't be. So that says there's a lot of people that will be saved during this period. And this is not all of them, because as we'll find out later, is there going to be a number of believers living on the earth who go in to populate the millennial kingdom. And so it says from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages. So as John looks at this, somehow he recognizes there are people from all over the earth. And again, I think this is part of one of the places where we get a global sense of what's going on here, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages. So later we're going to get a little bit more insight into who these people are. It says, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. So we're back now in a heavenly setting. This is the setting we saw in Revelation 4 and 5, if we're in the temple, in the throne room of God in heaven. The Father is seated on the throne and the Lamb is there with him. And these individuals are clothed in white robes, indicating their righteous state, I think, with palm branches in their hand. Now, this is curious. I almost said, does that mean there are palm trees growing in heaven? I'm not going to answer that question because I have no idea. But let me say this. I think this may just be part of John's vision here as he sees these, but I think there's a sense in which it reminds us of the triumphal entry of Christ into Jerusalem. And as MacArthur indicates regarding this, he says these usually are associated with a celebration, with deliverance, with joy. And that's what we see here, a celebration in heaven as these people are standing there before God on the throne. They're crying out with a loud voice. You know, I don't think I mentioned this last time when we were together, but MacArthur notes how noisy it will be in heaven. The phrase loud voice or sound occurs about 20 times in the book of Revelation. And it's interesting, even go back to the Psalms, multiple times we read, shout to the Lord. You know, shout. So everyone, it might be noisy, but our ears will be able to handle that okay, I think. So salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. So here again, we have a reference to God the Father sitting on the throne, and the Son with him. Salvation belongs to God. What does that mean? Well, I think the idea is that salvation can be found in one place and one place alone. Its only source is God. Only God can give it. So I think it's an acknowledgement of God's saving grace. And then John writes, all the angels were standing around the throne and around the elders and the four living creatures. So these elders, again, this is very much like the scene we saw in chapters 4 and 5. They're in the throne room of God. These are standing around the throne, and it says they fell on their faces before the throne and worship God. So as we often find here in the book of Revelation, when they worship, they fall down prostrate before God. This is what they do. And here's what they say, amen. So this indicates their agreement with what the martyrs had just said, where they had said salvation belongs to God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. So they're endorsing, they're saying amen to what they had said. And they are extolling God for that. And it's interesting, the angels are included in this. So you say, well, wait a minute, the angels were never the subjects of saving grace. They were not. However, I think we can say that there is a sense that we can say that they have salvation in the sense that they are the subjects of electing grace. Because Paul, in writing to Timothy, talks to the fact that the elect angel refers to elect angels. These are the angels who did not fall. So that is by God's grace as well. So they understand that, I think. So they say, blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever. So we see this as they stand there in God's presence, express who he is, what he's like, what he's doing, and so worship him. Now, at this point, John becomes involved in the vision. It says, one of the elders addressed me. This is something similar to what happened in chapter 5 when we looked and John was, when John had wept and the elder come, or the, this case, an elder comes and asks John a question. Here so, he says, who are these clothed in white robes and from where have they come? And so this is a rhetorical question. The elder wants to make sure John knows who these people are. And so John says, sir, you know. So John recognizes that this elder knows. And the elder responds, these are the ones coming out of the great tribulation. So he answers his own question. So these obviously appear to be saints who have been killed during the course of the 70th week. Now, the verb here is a present tense, the ones coming out. So this could indicate there are more to come. And he talks about the fact that they are coming out of the great tribulation. So since this is a term often used, or it is used, in reference to the second half of the 70th week, this may indicate the timing here of when this is taking place. So again, this may refer to a group, at least in part, that's mentioned in connection with the fifth seal in 611. 611, John writes, then they, that is the martyrs who were in heaven, were each given a white robe and told to rest a little longer until the number of their fellow servants and their brothers should be complete, who were to be killed as they themselves had been killed. So again, we're in heaven, we're witnessing something. A number of God's children have been killed. They're in heaven, but there are more to come. And this group is distinct from the 144,000, I think, who we will see. Again, it said they were from every tribe and nation, so this is not Jews. It's probably emphasizing that these are primarily, at least, Gentiles who are there, and I think perhaps representing the fruit of the ministry of the 144,000. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. So here is a picture of salvation. They have been cleansed from their sins, and because they have washed, they will be enjoying the blessings of salvation. This is similar to the idea that we read in 22:14, where John says, blessed are those who wash their robes so that they may have the right to the tree of life and they may enter the city by the gates. And this is, again, when we get into Revelation 22, we're talking about new heaven, new earth. So in these three verses, again, basically we're seeing blessing there. Note the therefore. Blessings particularly for those coming out of the great tribulation. And some of these, I think, relate primarily to their situation. In other words, they are blessed in a special way because they've gone through special circumstances and they actually have been martyred. They've died for their faith, whether willingly or not, they have died. And they are before the throne. And that's one of the blessings that they have. They have the privilege of being before the throne. And they serve him, that is God, the Father, sitting on the throne, day and night in his temple. And so they have the privilege of serving in his temple. And this, I believe, is the heavenly temple. We're talking about the heavenly temple here, not the one here on earth. Night and day indicates a continual, ongoing service. And he who sits on the throne will shelter them in his presence. So God the Father, the one seated on the throne, is going to take a special role in sheltering them. And again, this may be especially significant for these people who have come out of this tribulation, who have been martyred. You know, God says, okay, I'm going to shelter you with his presence. And I think that indicates a closeness there they will have. Perhaps similar to the one where Jesus talks about our security that we have by being in his hand and cannot be plucked out of his hand. And there he's being pictured as a shepherd, which we're going to see brought into this context as well. They shall hunger no more, neither thirst any more. The sun shall not strike them, nor any scorching heat. Now, again, I think this is especially significant for these people. Because remember, what have they come out? They have come out of the tribulation time, this 70th week, where all these judgments have been poured out on earth, hunger and thirst, there's been famine and things where, you know, water supplies have been infected. There has been, the sun has been struck to produce great heat. So they're coming out of this period. And so this promise has special significance to these people here. He says, four, and this is, indicates in a sense how some of these things are being implemented. He says, for the Lamb in the midst of the throne will be their shepherd. So not only will they enjoy the shelter of the one seated on the throne, but the Lamb will be their shepherd. And it says, he will guide them to springs of living water. Several times we read in the Gospel of John of living water. Jesus spoke of it with reference to the woman at the well, if you recall. And he spoke it of, Jesus said, living water will spring up in believers. And again, the fact that Jesus is referred to, or the Lamb is referred to here as their shepherd, I think takes us back, even as we think about this, to something as simple as Psalm 23, 1 and 2, where the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restores my soul, and so forth. So we have these promises being fulfilled for them. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. So here the group that this is affecting is the great multitude, because that is the one that they're being spoken of here. Every tear will be wiped away. And again, think of the context. Think of where these people have come from. This would be specifically or especially significant to them, because they've come out of such a difficult period of judgments being poured out on earth. So, as we've seen the 144,000 sealed, and now we've seen what appear to be the fruit of their labor, the great multitude. Now let's quickly look at the 144,000 upon Zion. This is in chapter 14. Many, and when I say many, I'm talking about conservatives who look at Scripture the way we do, many would agree that this 144,000 is the same 144,000 that were sealed in chapter 7. However, they do have differences in where this takes place and when this takes place. Now, as you can see from what I've written here, they are now in the throne room of heaven during the 70th week. So I see this event, this vision, taking place in heaven during the course of the 70th week. So John says, I looked, and behold, on Mount Zion stood the Lamb. So regarding this place, Mount Zion, see, this is where part of the debate enters the picture. Among those who see the 70th week, two suggestions. First of all, this Mount Zion is in heaven. And second, it is Mount Zion here on earth. Now, those who hold that is Mount Zion here on earth would see this as post-tribulation. They see it after Christ's return. So they would say the location and the time is different. They would say, too, that for the ones who believe it's in heaven, they would say, yes, it's a heavenly Zion, and it takes place earlier during the heaven. So unfortunately, we cannot make a decision based on Mount Zion itself, because not only is Mount Zion referred to as a heavenly place, it is also referred to as an earthly place. So the name itself, to me, does not settle the question. I think we have to notice the references here that we see to settle the question. Notice here the references, you know, he's with the Lamb, and notice they were singing a new song before the throne, before the four living creatures, and before the elders. Well, we're back in chapter 4 again. This is the exact same setting we found in chapter 4 and 5. So the setting of this singing that they're doing, to me, is clearly heavenly. It's not earthly, and I think it is still, that would indicate that the where is in heaven and the when is during the 70th week. So the 144,000 who had his name and his father's name written on their foreheads. We mentioned that. And I heard a sound from heaven like the roar of many waters and like the sound of thunder. So John hears a sound. We would say, it says voice, I think. We would say the sound of voices, if you will. What John is hearing is singing. He's hearing these people singing. The sound I heard was like the harpist playing on their harps. Now, I don't think the singing was sound like the sound of the harp. I think it's indicating that the singing was harmonious. It was melodious, like we would hear from a harp. These people were singing. It wasn't discordant singing. It was melodious singing that John is hearing. And they were singing a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and before the elders. Now, the content of their song is a new song. Now, earlier in chapter 5, we saw a new song, and that was the song that was sung when the Lamb took the seven-sealed scroll. And several times, particularly in the Psalms, we find references to new songs. And these new songs appear to be songs of joy and praise. And he says, no one could learn the song except the 144,000. Now, I don't think this is learned in the fact that, you know, they didn't understand the words or they couldn't, you know, learn the words. It's only that they could not sing it because it didn't apply to them. This is a song, I think, that is unique to these martyrs who have been martyred and redeemed from the earth. So God has redeemed them from the earth. So they sing, and I think they're rejoicing and praising God by means of this song. Let me say this. The reference here is God has redeemed them from the earth. Now, we can look at this and say perhaps we should not assume that they were killed by the forces opposing God. It's possible some of them were. Maybe they all are. But it may be that as we're looking at these 144,000, what we're seeing is their ministry is complete. And the fact that their ministry is complete, God has called them to heaven. This is very similar when we get to the inset that deals with the two witnesses. God puts two witnesses on earth, and when he's done with them, they're killed, but they're resurrected, and then what God calls them brings them up to heaven. So it could be very similar. But anyway, these 144,000 will be taken to heaven. So it is for these who have not defiled themselves with women, for they are virgins. This seems an unusual statement. Why put this here? MacArthur suggests this. He says, during this period when the beast is worshipped, he says, similar with cult worship, the worship of the Antichrist will be, he says, unspeakably vile and perverse, and sexual sin will apparently run rampant. So what is being said is these people did not defile themselves in what they did, and they are very distinct from what's going on here on earth. It is these who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. So they are loyal to him. They have been redeemed from mankind as first fruits for God and the Lamb. So it's been suggested that as Jews, these may represent the first Jews that are saved during this period, and more will be, as there will be Jews going into the millennium as well. So they come to be saved, and that during this present period of during that present period of time, and in their mouth was found no lie. Again, contrasting it with the lying of the beast, these people were truthful. They proclaimed the truth, and if you will, nothing but the truth. And then John says, "For they are blameless." That doesn't mean they're sinless. It means, in the sense that Paul says, he was without blame. They were above reproach, in that sense.